This is WGNS Action Line. Action Line. Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers for 78 years.
Since 1947.
It's how my day begins.
It's how this day begins.
This is WGNS Action Line. Now your host, Scott Walker.
This morning we have a doctor on the air with us from Murfreesboro Medical Clinic, Dr. Michael Derrick. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. So you focus on things like allergies, problems with the immune system, asthma, all of that stuff.
Yep. We're pretty broad. We're allergy and immunology. More heavy on the allergy side in our practice, but it gives us the ability to see all ages for, like you said, asthma, eczema. You may also see it called atopic dermatitis. Nasal allergies, eye allergies, but we also see things that people may not think about, like stinging insect allergies, venom allergies, chronic hives, and food allergies, all of those broad things as well.
And for those listening, you can text in any questions, 615-893-1450. Starting off, what got you into this line of medicine?
So I actually started out in medical school. I went to East Tennessee. I'm from an East Tennessee boy and raised. And after medical school, I originally planned on doing pediatrics, which is where I did my residency in Charleston, South Carolina. During residency, you're able to do some additional what we call electives to kind of explore both the primary care and the more specialty world as well. And I did some rotations in allergy and immunology and found that it really hit the combination of what I was looking for, where involving my history with learning about biochemistry in college and school, so the science background, as well as education. Both of my parents were educators, teachers in elementary schools. So I really enjoyed educating and then still combining that ability to still take care of patients directly. So it's allergy and immunology is a great field where you can actually affect positively quality of life and see those changes with things like eczema, asthma control, help with food anxieties. So you really can improve quality of life in the field, and it's a great mixture of science and people.
And growing up in Tennessee, you are very well versed in all the different problems with allergies here then.
Absolutely. I grew up with allergies and asthma. My mom has had chronic sinus disease. My sister had asthma. So we've definitely seen the effects ourselves.
And right now, I guess what, ragweed pollen? That's one of the problems?
Yeah, so at this time of year, we're kind of transitioning from grass pollen season to more of the weed season. And so definitely ragweed is one of our big contenders. In Tennessee, in this part of the country, we usually start off in the springtime with trees, and they can even show up as late as February. As early as February, and then kind of March-ish. But tree season in the spring, and then we kind of blend into grass season in the summer, and then the weeds show up in the fall. But even sometimes of the year, we get a little bit of everything.
When you look at allergies to things like that versus food allergies, it always seems like you always hear that food allergies are, 10 times worse. You have to carry an EpiPen if allergic to peanuts and shellfish. And it seems like peanuts and shellfish kind of host the show. It's what everybody talks about the most when it comes to food allergies.
You can technically have a food allergy to any food. There are more common foods than others. Currently, there are nine of the most, there's nine most common food allergens in the U.S. currently. But yes, in general, it's the same immune response, the same mechanism. We call it an antibody called IgE or immunoglobulin E. It's the same immune response in the body that is causing the symptoms with food allergy as well as environmental allergies. Environmental allergies do tend to be less severe, although I have seen some extreme cases of people like allergic to cat who may have an EpiPen because it really triggers their asthma, or I've heard of a pretty severe case where someone had anaphylaxis to what was presumed to be like cockroach in the past. And so it's not common, but it is possible. Just food allergies tend to be potentially more potential for life-threatening events.
But now, things like pollen, as an example, have you ever heard of any condition where somebody is that extremely allergic to things like pollen where they have to carry an EpiPen?
if they have underlying asthma and it really flares up the asthma, that I would say is definitely a consideration. We've had some patients with asthma who have had admissions in the ICU before, so I definitely keep in mind potential triggers for those people, but for their underlying asthma. I haven't personally had a patient that needed it as much for the pollens, like the seasonal events, but I have had a few patients with like cat allergy, because it is so, it's what we call like a sticky allergen. It sticks around, so even if you take the cat out of the house, it sticks around for weeks, months after, and it can definitely be causing more severe symptoms.
We already had a question here, and they were asking about, let's see, what is the number one thing that I guess best prescription for, or the best thing to get in order to help manage allergies, common allergies such as pollen?
Definitely depends on the age. We have an array of medications for your targeted symptoms, from oral medications like oral antihistamines, what we call leukotriene modifiers. So things like Montelukast, which is also that's the generic name of it. I don't know if I can say brand names, then nasal sprays. There's multiple different types of nasal sprays, medications, and then eye drops. So technically, depending on older kids and adults, technically the nasal sprays are first line, but that can definitely be a struggle in the little ones, and so not all little ones love to do nasal sprays. So there's some formulations though that we can talk with you about that may be better tolerated, some more sensitive ones, and even some nasal sprays some people don't tolerate as well as others based on the formulation. So that's something that we definitely personalize and go through and make sure you're tolerating it, but ultimately potentially some combination of those. But for an adult, most likely the nasal sprays to start, and then oral antihistamines, and then eye drops, pending additional symptom control. Allergy immunotherapy or we call it allergy shots, and there's some called sublingual immunotherapy, are also great ways to modify your allergies. They're ways to actually change your immune response over time, so you can decrease your symptoms, decrease your medication needs. That's something we do offer. They're made special. When we make allergy shots, they're made special for each person based on your allergy profile. And so we go over candidacy for that, review your medical history. Some places will offer what's called allergy drops. Those are not technically FDA approved use of the extracts, and so they're often going to be out of pocket, whereas what we offer usually will be covered either entirely or largely by insurance. And we talked to you about that before we start them.
When looking at things like nasal sprays, or maybe taking Claritin and a nasal spray, when you look at those types of medicines, how fast acting are they with just seasonal allergies?
Some of them are very quick. Some of them take a little bit longer. And so that's where we kind of get into personalizing the regimen to each person's symptoms at the time, because each person may need a different level. The antihistamines by mouth usually will take effect that day, within an hour or so, may even get better control from them after using them consistently for 3 or so days in a row. The nasal sprays, depending on the type, so the intranasal steroids, you may have heard like fluticasone or mometasone. There's certain different intranasal steroids. Those can have effect early on, but really have maximal effect after about a week or two. And then there's nasal antihistamines like azelastine, olopatadine. Those work quickly, but not just as long. And so those should have effect pretty much the same day. But actually, we also have combination nasal sprays where you get an added benefit, a synergistic effect from both of them.
What are those nasal sprays? If we get over-the-counter nasal sprays, what are the ones that are really geared towards allergies or seasonal allergies?
One allergy antihistamine nasal spray that's available over the counter is azelastine. Are we allowed to say name brands or anything? So Astepro, you may see it called like over the counter. Then other ones that you may see are like Flonase, Nasacort, Nasonex used to be around. That's the top ones I can think of off the top of my head. But then there's Rhinocort. There's a whole array that used to be prescription, and pretty much everything's over the counter now. But we often can try to prescribe it to see if insurance will cover it, and oftentimes they may.
And so those are the ones that they work well, but usually take about a week to get full effect.
Yeah, at the Flonase and the intranasal steroids in that class may take a week or two to get the maximal effect from it. So I usually tell people, if you use it and feel like, well, that didn't do anything, that keep with it and don't just trash it just yet. And so sometimes that is what's frustrating for patients, is kind of needing that immediate effect. And so we can then talk about like the combination regimens and the, again, based on age, because some of the nasal antihistamines will have some bitter aftertaste. And so working with you based on age and preferences, we can try to choose the ones for you that we think are best tolerated by age and preference.
Now for that 40, 50 year old who has had allergies their whole life, they have them year round from everything, be it the pollen to cats and dogs, you know, you name it. The idea of getting a shot, how well would that help somebody like that? And again, how often do you get the shot?
Great question. The allergy shots are used for people who have significant symptoms with coinciding positives on testing that seem to trigger, that fit with their trigger times. The allergy shots, not everyone necessarily needs them. They're definitely an elective process. But if your symptoms are causing you significant quality of life with either allergic eyes, allergic nose, asthma triggered by allergies, and or eczema, so any of those conditions, when people have a desire to better control symptoms that are not controlled by medications or reduce medication, then the allergy immunotherapy is certainly an option. We go over there's some restrictions from recommendations of certain medical conditions or medications that we would review with you, but many people are a contender for it. Those usually, and there's variations of the dosing regimen, but usually starting out in what's called the buildup phase, you can get an injection once or twice or so a week. Usually there's some faster regimens, but we space it out so people can kind of get used to it. The injections are very, very, very small needles. They're recommended even down to 5 years old. And so we have several kids who kind of were hesitant in the beginning, but they tolerate it. And we even use some what we call the cold spray to kind of numb up the area. So patient comfort is definitely important. And all the facilities that you need are all right in our clinic, like a little waiting room to monitor you. We have the bathrooms right there. So everything's available. But once you go through that buildup phase, which takes probably around six to eight months, then you get to what's called your maintenance phase, where you're building up the strength of those shots to really the goal or effective dose. You still may get effects in the buildup phase, but really we're marching to this goal concentration. That usually is going to ultimately be spaced out to once a month. Okay. And so the total course of allergy shots to get that sustained long-term effect of your immune system change is about 3 to 5 years. But once you hit maintenance, technically you should be getting the effect from them. And so, you know, I've had people who even just started them and already feel great. Wow. I had a patient walk by recently and say, she just kind of walked by, we called a drive-by, and she was like, it's the best spring I've ever had. So I've had people who moved in with their fiancés and suddenly, you know, now they're able to tolerate their pets that they couldn't before. So things like that are great success stories.
You know, I don't think people really truly realize the effect that allergies may have on them until they're allergy free because of medication or because of shots, whatever it may be. But how big of an impact do allergies have on people? I mean, everything from making them tired, making, you know, their nose run. What do you see on a regular basis?
I see everything from, you know, I have a sniffle for 1 week out of the year, or I get a sniffle around the cat, to I have full-blown hives when the dog licks me, or it triggers my asthma. So everybody's different. That's why we have to personalize your plan and your history and your testing to each person and management. But definitely it is a potential for a significantly quality of life effector. It can make people miss work, miss school. I've had many people have to miss for runny nose and can't control it, or if your asthma is uncontrolled, we get kind of worried with the persistent cough with other kids. The kind of sending them home from school for those concerns. But it can definitely have significant impacts. But that's the cool thing, is we usually can get those things under control.
Pretty awesome that you can actually get that under control and you can actually live a normal life. And maybe feel like what it should feel like.
And kind of like you said, there's some degree of awareness that, like, people who have asthma or uncontrolled allergies, sometimes they don't realize it could be better because they've just always lived with it. And so once we, you know, do a breathing test called spirometry for your asthma and see that your lung function is maybe not what we expected it, then, you know, subsequently we hear like, oh, actually I'm able to run a lot better. I'm not coughing through the night. I have better tolerance. So we see people who didn't quite know that they were experiencing it because they just never had relief from it.
This next question here, it says, I've been diagnosed with fibromyalgia. I am 45 years of age. I have had every test under the sun, and I don't have any other real problems, but I'm constantly fatigued. Could this be somehow related to an allergy of some sort?
It would depend on additional symptom history. So food allergies are oftentimes kind of a question of those types of thing. Usually we wouldn't pinpoint a suspected food allergy from that specific history. Usually an allergic reaction to a food or a medication is usually going to be within an hour or two most commonly. The environmental allergies, certainly if you're having snoring or frequent nasal congestion, runny nose, drip down your throat that's disrupting your sleep, or otherwise just kind of constantly triggering your immune system, if you're having those frequent symptoms, it certainly can contribute to fatigue. But I would say fatigue by itself, I would not necessarily be my first thought, but I'd want to know more history.
What about things like gluten? You hear that people are trying to avoid gluten. Mm. What kind of problems, if you're truly allergic to gluten, what kind of problems would that cause in a person?
That's a good question. It gets a little tricky with what definition or what specific word we use. And the words that are used in literature also can get a little confusing. So when we talk about a food allergy, most of the time we're talking about, brace yourself, there's science coming, an IgE, that immunoglobulin E-based process. So that is the typical peanut allergy, EpiPen. Most of those will present within immediate to 1 to 2 hours from ingestion of the food. Most commonly would resolve within about 24 hours from the exposure. It's kind of the same pattern of environmental allergies, but that's where if there's an ingestion or some other contact with symptoms pretty quickly, that's what makes us think about that process. Those are different than like sensitivities and intolerances, and that's where the history is really important as well, because something like celiac disease, which is that gluten allergy, it's actually a different immune response. It's a different antibody. So there's another type of testing for that, usually guided by GI, but there's a blood test that we could check. But then that itself is different from like when people have a general kind of intolerance or sensitivity to a food that we may not have evidence of testing or immune system activation. So the more traditional IgE-based allergies, those are ones that can range from vomiting, diarrhea, hives, swelling. Skin findings are extremely common with allergic reactions. Trouble breathing, you know, throat swelling. If people say things like that, definitely I'm concerned. The gluten, like celiac disease, those are often kind of longer term, like bloating, diarrhea, unexplained weight loss, could explain some failure to thrive in a kid. I had a friend actually in medical school who felt awful for a long time, having constant GI complaints, and later was diagnosed with celiac disease. And then that's different itself again from maybe an intolerance or sensitivity to the food, where people aren't having necessarily any of those symptoms, but say like my joint aches, or sometimes we hear like red dye makes my kid kind of emotional or moody. Certainly you can have those symptoms. It just may not be detectable by our testing because it's not the same underlying mechanism that we can test for.
Interesting. So things like being allergic to gluten, it comes with a much larger picture. I mean, you're talking about a disease there.
Yeah, with using the word allergy, we have to sometimes really narrow down what does that mean to you. And because, again, there's underlying different mechanisms and different symptoms. So we broadly toss that term around, but how we manage those conditions and diagnose are all very different.
Again, with us this morning from Murfreesboro Medical Clinic, we have Dr. Michael Derrick. We're going to take a short break, and then we will be right back. And again, our number, if you want to text in a question, 615-893-1450. Again, we will be right back.
Broadcasting from the Middle Tennessee Electric Studios, MTE Sharing Change has now donated more than $11 million to local nonprofits assisting worthy causes in our community. MTE, serving to make life better since 1936.
When the unexpected happens, fire, water, or storm damage, Farrah Construction can help. Fair Construction is also there to help when a car slams through the wall, and that seems to happen more often these days. I'm Ron Hall. Let our family at Fair Construction help you. Call Fair Construction and we'll board up, put down tarps, secure your home or business until the insurance coverage is approved. I'm Ron Hall. Shop local. Let our family business help you. Fair Construction Company.
Dozens of vendors. One local tradition.
Plump, juicy tomatoes.
The Farmer's Market. Every Tuesday and Friday, 7 a.m. to 1.
Pick fresh this morning.
At Lane Agri Park in Murfreesboro.
Farm fresh eggs.
At 315 John R. Rice Boulevard.
50 years strong. Come see why.
This is Peter Demas, and our family is inviting your family to come eat with us at Demas's Restaurant. We really focus on value. They get value. They get more than what they pay for. They get a higher level service. They get higher level food at a price that is a lot more affordable. What we're trying to do is we're trying to give people the value, and again, that they were fulfilled both within their stomach and as well as their pockets. We want them to feel satisfied. Come eat with us at Demas's Restaurant on Northwest Broad Street.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
Our guest today in studio from Murfreesboro Medical Clinic, and that's the West Lawn location, Dr. Michael Derrick. And you help folks with everything from allergies to problems that may attack the immune system.
Absolutely. That's a great way to say it. I also really enjoy this specialty because we get to work with other specialties. We also see a couple conditions I left out earlier, things like eosinophilic esophagitis. We often collaborate with GI.
I hear that every day.
Yeah. Right, tip of your tongue.
That's right.
We shorten it to EOE because we get tired of saying eosinophilic esophagitis. EOE is a cross condition that we manage with GI often. Nasal polyps we often manage with the ear, nose, and throat doctors. So yes, all those typical allergy things, asthma, allergic eyes, allergic nose, and then we do some of those more specialized ones too.
I mean, you're talking about diving pretty deep. So, I mean, if somebody comes in and they present XYZ problems, you're not just looking for allergies.
Yeah, history is the key that helps us make all of our decisions. We often get outside records, but really going back to the story and as many details as we can get about the timeline and what were the symptoms and best as people can remember. But it's trying to figure out which bucket you fit into, of which pattern we think, and if we think this testing will help or that testing, and even not to overwhelm people with the science part, but when we talked about those immediate type food allergies, the typical like peanut, there's other food allergies that are less well recognized called like FPIES, food protein induced enterocolitis syndrome, that can have like recurrent vomiting. That's an immune mechanism, but just a different process. You may hear about kids who have like blood in the stool when they're little. So that's a good example of kind of what word we use. So with cow milk, you can have the immediate type reaction where you need like an EpiPen prescription. You can have the type of cow milk allergy where kids have blood in the stool and it can kind of drop their hemoglobin over time. You can have lactose intolerance, which has a different underlying mechanism, but can have the same like nausea symptoms, upset stomach, diarrhea, bloating. And then technically you could have FPIES. So that's four different body type reactions to the same food that are possible. So history combined with testing and exam are always what we have to rely on. To the testing itself does not tell us the whole story.
A patient out there listening who may have been having problems maybe their whole life, maybe they're 30 years old, 35, mm-hmm. and they've had issues of some sort their whole life, they've just never been able to really nail it down, and the doctor's visits that they've had in the past haven't really led them anywhere. They've been told you're healthy for the most part. Mm-hmm. I guess starting to write down and have a diary of things you eat would be a good starting point if you're trying to really truly figure out what's going on.
Absolutely. That's a great suggestion. We typically will, if we have a first visit and it doesn't immediately jump out at us as a cause and effect food or trigger. Keeping a symptom diary is often what we will recommend, or a food diary. And sometimes the absence of a pattern still helps us to know that some, like many conditions or conditions like chronic hives or chronic urticaria, it's also called, most of those cases are not going to have an identifiable trigger, but that's kind of our last assumption. We go through the history carefully and consider some evaluation to see if there's triggers, but many that's something that's probably not as well known, as things like hives can be due to allergic triggers, but they can also be due to non-allergic triggers like an illness with kids, but they're activating the same parts of the immune system, so it looks just like an allergy, but as we see the pattern unfold and looking for a symptom diary of not really seeing an exact pattern, we see that it may be just what we call chronic idiopathic urticaria, meaning we don't have an identifiable cause.
What you were talking about with gluten, for example, somebody comes in, they're presenting these problems, and turns out it's not just an allergy, it's a disease that you're suffering from, and here's an avenue you could take to get treatment.
Yeah, and that's part of the great part about allergy too, is many of the tests that we complete, we rely heavily on what's called skin testing, but also there's lab testing, blood testing that can be done. Skin testing, we get results the same day, the same visit. Not everyone can complete it. It depends, but on the patient, medications they're on, and things like that, a tolerance. But I'd say a vast majority of people can complete skin testing with some preparation, and we get results the same day, and that helps us give a guide if we're suspicious as well. We may also follow up with a lab test depending on the situation, but you know, for any allergy testing that's off there, I've seen some panels that you can buy online or do at home. I would use caution. I tell people exactly what I would tell my family. You know, especially if you're doing like a huge food panel, the testing alone doesn't tell us the story. We always have to incorporate it with the history. And so with any test result, how does that affect you? How does that fit into your life? And what are we going to do with that result? I used to train with people who, you know, would call it more of an art than a perfect science. And people may hear me say that often, because I used to be like, well, there has to be a perfect answer. But it's true. It is more of an art than a perfect science. And I had a colleague who used to say, it's hard to practice good allergy. You know, it's easy to send somebody home and say, don't eat these 30 foods, but really drilling down to say, like, we were really concerned about this one food. These other were just tested to make that relevant to you.
Insects. I would say that's another big area that you're familiar with, because there's a lot of people out there with allergic reactions, I guess, to certain insects. And this question was, my son has an allergy to bee stings, and I'm always fearful of him going outside to play, especially during the summer. I hate to say it, but I'd prefer them playing indoors on video games more so than hanging outside because of this fear. What can I do to help this situation?
So definitely we would want to go through that history. That's always going to be my first part. The history and going through their other medical conditions and such, and what happened as best we can identify during the visit or during that reaction event. There's guidelines that evolve over time, so staying up to date on those are important for us. But depending on what the reaction was, we may have, you know, like an epinephrine auto-injector. We also call commonly EpiPen, but there's other options available as a backup. If the symptoms fit more of a systemic reaction, then you may be a candidate for what's called the allergy immunotherapy or allergy shots for venom allergies. That is one thing we can test for the venoms in our clinic. Currently, we don't have the extracts for skin testing, but I can facilitate if we think that needs to be done. We can always start the process and get you geared up. That's one thing that is one of my favorite things to talk about, venom allergies, because if you've had a true systemic reaction to a venom allergy reaction, then the allergy shots can significantly reduce your potential of a life-threatening event as soon as you hit the maintenance dosing. So those even may be considered less than 5, depending on the doctor and comfort. When I was in my fellowship training at Vanderbilt, was where I did additional allergy training for board certification. I remember doing a presentation on kind of a pediatric protocol to kind of get venom immunotherapy at a younger age. So those options are definitely out there. I catch those sometimes in my family conversations with patients because I was like, oh, dad has a bee allergy. And I'm like, but what happened? Does he have an EpiPen? You know, so there's some extenuating circumstances too about if you're a beekeeper or like a habit, if you have a hobby or something that keeps you frequently exposed on ways that we can, you know, would you be a candidate as well to help reduce your symptoms?
You know, it's scary for, you know, parents. when it comes to children with allergies, but it's scary for adults too when you start talking about the need to carry an EpiPen, because that tells you obviously the allergic reaction to whatever it is much more serious, and anaphylactic shock is one of those big ones, I guess, and that's pretty scary.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a degree of the anxiety that comes with it. I think it's all in how you frame it mentally and in the visit. So I've had colleagues who felt like prescribing EpiPens were maybe anxiety provoking, but I always have that conversation with the family that if you feel more, you know, in cases where I feel like maybe it's not absolutely necessary, we could wait. If the family feels happier having it, we've discussed the risks and benefits of it, and we'll use it as a bridge until we maybe get more information. And then once we have gone X amount of time without an event, or we do some additional evaluation and clear food or something, then we maybe just don't renew it. So there are definitely options. There's a new nasal spray option that people may qualify for as well that is less maybe fear-inducing than the injection. But we don't hand them out like candy. Not everybody that comes gets an EpiPen. But my general approach is, if something worried you enough to bring you in to do testing and you're avoiding the food because of that, until I can do additional evaluation, I usually will offer it if I'm concerned by the history. My typical spiel is that unless I watch you eat it myself, I can't completely clear it just yet. So it's all based on what the patient's comfortable with. Does it help? Does it add or alleviate anxiety? And do I think it's necessary or not? But even in those kind of gray areas, if it gives comfort, as long as the patient understands risks and benefits, we can talk about it further.
So if that patient is allergic to a bee sting, as an example, and they carry an EpiPen with them, injecting that EpiPen, it in some cases, from what I understand, it doesn't totally stop the whole process of your throat closing up. It may just slow it down enough to get to the hospital if it's a serious enough condition.
So education is a huge part of my practice. Again, because my parents were both teachers in elementary schools, I remember my mom having like a drawer. We're from a really small town. There wasn't a school nurse. I didn't even know about school nurses. I thought that was just on TV. I remember my mom having a drawer full of like albuterols and EpiPens and not feeling comfortable with the training. So that's something I definitely focus on. For my patients who I think need an EpiPen or epinephrine prescription, we always try to give them what's called a food allergy or anaphylaxis plan that's a printed step-by-step of when do we do Benadryl, when do we do, or similar antihistamine, when do we use epinephrine. And so not every clinic does that, but I like having that physical resource of if you had this event, how to treat it. So to the question of you know, epinephrine is first line for anaphylaxis. Early use of it has been shown to have significant impact on being life-saving. We take precautions with the newer guidelines suggest having two devices. If we think you need one, we want you to have two. And that's something I often catch in my patients from other places, or just that we've prescribed, and double check on those. The reason to have two is in case something happens to the first one. I had a patient drive over his with a lawnmower. Or if you use it and you're not getting better after 5 minutes approximately, you can use the second device. That's all detailed on that form, but also put it in the prescription labeling, so it's on the box that people carry around. I often recommend people make what's called an anaphylaxis kit, where you have your EpiPens, some liquid or chewable Benadryl, a printed copy of the plan I make it. And then if you have asthma, your inhaler as well. And epinephrine's great. And you know, many people get nervous about, do I have to call the 911? Do I have to go to the hospital? And I've had people actually say, like, I tried not to use it. Absolutely, that's the wrong way to look at it. We want you to use it. And the reason for calling emergency care is to make sure your symptoms don't come back and that they've resolved. People may have symptoms return a secondary event. So usually in the emergency room, if there's been a significant event, they'll do an observation of 4 hours or so.
Again, with us this morning, Dr. Michael Derrick with MMC Westlawn. And for those listening, that is the location over there around I-840.
Yes, right off Veterans Parkway. You'll see the address says Shores Road, but probably not many people can identify that. So it's off Veterans Parkway right near 840. There's a new Publix Westlawn right there. It's a very up-and-coming area. It's growing fast.
We recently had on the air the Agriculture Extension Service, and they were talking about ticks and problems with diseases that come from ticks. And the subject came up of Lyme disease and alpha-gal being two of the big ones, I guess, that we see in the South. Is one or the other more common, and are they similar in nature as far as the symptoms and long-term impacts on somebody's life?
From tick disease versus alpha-gal?
I guess both of them, alpha-gal syndrome and then Lyme disease as well.
They're both due to tick bites, but very, very different processes. So Lyme disease and some of those other tick-borne illnesses are actually due to an infection that usually will need to be treated. And so those respond to things like antibiotics and possibly have to see like an infectious disease doctor for long-term management. But those types of rashes, you know, where you get like the bullseye that spreads and stuff like that, those are infectious causes. The alpha-gal allergy, again, brace yourself, science. The full name is galactose one, or let's see, I wrote it down just because we always shorten it to alpha-gal. Galactose alpha 1,3 galactose. So what happens is a carbohydrate which is like a sugar that's in the tick saliva can get transmitted into the human when we get bitten by the tick. And so we don't have that in our body. So it's a different component that we can become allergic to. The tricky part is, if we've become allergic to that same IgE allergy process, like peanut allergy and such, that component is found on other mammal meats. So like beef and pork and lamb, deer, all those things. So we don't carry it on ourselves, but hopefully we're not out there, you know, but that's why we don't self-react.
Here's a free sugar molecule.
That is a immunologic response to not an infection, but to the component that is foreign to us. And so that is a food allergy that does not play by the typical rules. Instead of that 1 to 2 hour presentation, it can occur, but it's often delayed. So possibly 4 or 6 or so hours later. So people, when I hear people that say like, oh, I go to bed and I wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning and I'm itching and I've got hives, those people definitely raise my antenna. I had a teenager who went to camp for the summer and had 2 or 3 episodes of pretty severe hives. And then looking back, it was like, well, I did have a beef taco and then I had a steak. And then, so it's something that we have to, again, just keep our ears up for and be vigilant.
And then are there other problems that go along with that? I mean, if you weren't diagnosed right off the bat, oh, you've got this, you know, alpha-gal or it's Lyme disease, do they present problems later in life if they were undiagnosed in the very beginning?
Two very different pathways, I would say. The Lyme disease type things can cause maybe more like chronic problems, possibly more like joint issues, fatigue, those kinds of things, inflammatory responses. The alpha-gal allergy, I would say, it's a chronic condition, but unless you're eating that trigger food every day, you're not having chronic symptoms every day. It would be more in the line of like if I have a peanut allergy or a bee sting allergy, if I'm exposed to it, symptoms can occur. So it's chronic in the sense of you got it long term, but you may be dealing with the infectious problems more frequently. Alpha-gal can also, depending on severity, some people, again, not everyone, but some people may even be sensitive to the animal byproducts, such as sometimes cow milk can be cross-reactive and gelatin as well, which can present in other unusual ways, like sometimes surgical products, occasional vaccine. There's awareness there.
It really is interesting, though, to hear about the different insect bites and the gluten, because there are so many other problems out there, I guess, that people may be living with, and they don't really realize where it all started for them.
Yeah, I think, again, I focus really heavily on education to kind of put that symptom history into the right pathway and get you the right testing. And if I don't think it lives in our specialty, then getting you to the right specialty. And I always tell people, you know, just because the testing may be negative doesn't mean you're not having symptoms. It just may not be the right test, or maybe the test doesn't exist. So we have to treat, you know, what we're hearing and what we see and manage that.
We had another text here, and too long to read the whole thing on the air, but basically it was talking about how they've recently seen videos online about mold in people's houses and how it causes this long list of problems from fatigue to hives. Is there truth in that with mold being in people's households?
Also a very broad topic and something we do hear very commonly. So there's kind of different thought areas there as well as to what the effect is. So you can certainly be allergic to molds, just like the seasonal allergies that we were talking about. You know, trees and grasses and weeds, those are seasonal. There's perennial allergens. Molds can be indoor or outdoor, so potentially year-round there. Also things like pet, cat, dog, cockroach, dust mite. So those are examples of perennial allergens. So you can certainly have your eyes, nose allergies, your asthma, your eczema triggered by molds. There's also what people just from having particulate in the air. So if you go out on a high pollen day or the stuff, all this, the debris and stuff from molds in the air can just be irritating and trigger people as well. So those are non-allergic triggers. And then they can also cause other things like more, I think people are commonly worried about like the mycotoxins or the fungal toxins that can be potentially produced. That is something we don't specifically specialize in allergy and immunology typically, but we can help facilitate, you know, if we think we need to have you seen there. But again, going through the symptoms, is it, you know, some people's asthma will flare in a certain situation. That can be like a hypersensitivity pneumonitis, it's called. There's actually what's called fungal sinusitis that we usually find that on imaging and such. So there's some people's asthma is triggered by fungus as well, fungal infection. So really what the clinical picture is overall and the exam and plus or minus testing as well to help you get those. But I've had that come up with like mold remediation and water damage and that kind of stuff. I often will use resources from our big societies like the American College and American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, but also from the EPA. There's some guidelines there about home remediation.
Again, with us this morning, and we're already out of time, we have from Murfreesboro Medical Clinic, Dr. Michael Derrick. And again, you're with the West Lawn location, and if anybody has questions, I would say just Google MMC Westlawn, and that's the best route.
Absolutely. We have a phone number as well, 615-867-8055, that can get you directly to our scheduling. Or if you go to my page on MMC, I think if you click my face, it will bring up a link to make an appointment.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. And just a reminder, we do see all ages, and that's a great opportunity to take care of the whole family.
Sounds great. You're listening to WGNS Murfreesboro. Stay with us. We do have a lot more news and more coming your way in just a minute.